Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
Welcome to this discussion with the FT's Philip Stevens on the United Kingdom's place in the world. Philip, an award-winning journalist, is director of the editorial board and chief political commentator at the Financial Times, and has just published a book on the subject in question called Britain Alone, The Path from Suez to Brexit. I notice, Philip, that it's already in the happy position of having 4.5 stars on Amazon, so well done there. The book, which is on one level a post-war history of the West, explores a lot of themes, but for our purposes today, we'll look at its detailed depiction of the UK's seesawing relationship between the US and Europe. I noticed just last night, in fact, Philip, a piece on FT.com by Robert Zoellick setting out why the UK is a useful agent in world affairs and that the US should help the UK be successful in its own right, but also so that it can help influence the EU. So some familiar themes there, which we'll explore. We can come back to that in a moment, but first I'd like to explore the events your book starts with, namely the Suez crisis, which you explore in some detail. Why do you think that episode is significant today?
Well, the book, as you say, is essentially about Britain's efforts, some would say struggle, to find its place in the world after the Second World War and the dissolution of empire. In significant part, it's a story of exalted ambition, our understandable desire to hang on to a great power status in the world, and straitened economic circumstance, our relative economic decline and the rise of the US and the Soviet Union as the dominant actors on the international stage. And Suez, I think, was the first was the moment of when the initial post-war illusions fell away. There was this sense, you know, we'd won the war, but actually we'd been bankrupted by the war. But there was a sense for, you know, a decade beyond 1945 that we would somehow rebound, and that the hardships that we faced during that period would fall away. Our natural talents, our engineering, our science, and our connections throughout the world would bring us back to the top table. And Suez was an exercise in sort of imperial or post-imperial overreach. We were put in our place by the Americans, who effectively stopped the operation, and they stopped it very effectively by refusing us access to support funds for sterling. And post-Suez, we had to realize that although we might still be a great nation, we were certainly no longer a great power. We had to find another place in the world post-Suez.
We can explore whether we've managed to do that since then. You talk about the lessons that the UK and France took from the crisis, which are dramatically different. What were those conclusions, would you say, and were they the right ones?
Well, the most important conclusion that the British drew, and Anthony Eden, the author of the misadventure, gave way pretty quickly to Harold Macmillan. And Macmillan took the view that the central lesson of Suez was that we couldn't embark on such expeditions or enterprises without the support of the Americans. And the strategy that evolved in the last years of the 1950s, and it was set out pretty precisely by John Selwyn Lloyd, who was the Foreign Secretary, was that in future we would exercise our influence in global affairs through the Americans. We would be the Americans' best friends. We would have such a close relationship that we would, if you like, get the Americans subtly to do our bidding. There was this phrase that Macmillan himself had coined actually much earlier during the war, that the Brits could be Greeks to America's Rome. We would be the wise advisors telling the powerful Rome, America, how to deploy that power. The French, in complete contrast, decided that that our withdrawal from Suez showed the sort of perfidy of the English-speaking nations, and that they would actually need to build an integrated, united Europe, under French leadership, of course, as a counterpoint to American and indeed British power. So we went off in opposite directions. Neither, as it turned out, and I'm sure we'll come to this as we go on, neither turned out to be wholly successful. But that was the parting of the ways in 1956.
Inasmuch as we can tell, what do you think the US wanted at that stage from both the UK and France?
What the US wanted at that stage was a united, integrated Europe. The strategic goal of the Americans was essentially to contain the Soviet Union, and containing the Soviet Union meant keeping it out of Europe. And American policy had two essential pillars. One, economically, through the Marshall Plan, it wanted to encourage the reconstruction of Europe and, you know, particularly of Germany, but also the rest of Europe. And the second pillar was the political one. It felt that a more united, integrated Europe would be a more reliable ally for the United States. And it had encouraged Britain at the time of the creation of the coal and steel community in 1950 to actually join the enterprise, but we had said no. And from that point, from Suez onwards, the Americans were always trying to nudge us closer into the European project, the common market, and beyond the European community, etc. So the Americans were pro-Europeans, if you like.
Obviously, the closer the US and the UK are, the less leverage the UK is likely to have to be the Greeks to America's Rome. And we'll come back to that, as it's also a curious output, perhaps, of Brexit. The UK surmised then and since that the UK can't have an assertive foreign policy which is distinct from that of the US. The French don't always do that. Do you think that's right?
I think if you sort of look at it across the piece, across the 60 years, I think, you know, Britain has done well, broadly speaking, out of remaining close to the Americans in foreign policy. The problem, I think, is that we have sometimes exaggerated our own importance and sometimes worried too much about keeping that too close to the Americans. So there's always a danger in this relationship, because it's an asymmetric relationship, obviously. There's always a danger that special becomes servile, that we chase the Americans too much. And, you know, some would say that, for example, the Iraq war in 2003 was an example of a government and prime minister too anxious to please the Americans. But there have been other instances as well. So there's always been that, there's always that danger. And we tend to invest the relationship with all sorts of emotional baggage, if you like. We think about kith and kin and values and language and culture. If you talk to, and you know, one sees this in the papers going through the decades, to American politicians and officials, they take a more hard-headed view. For them, it's about national interest. They greatly respect the UK and they value the alliance, but it's really about American interests. There's nothing emotional or for them, there's none of the sort of romance that we sometimes invest in the relationship for the Americans. So, you know, if you look back, you'll find that at various points, as indeed with Suez, where the Americans that time actually voted with the Soviet Union at the UN against us, but later, smaller things, but, you know, Ronald Reagan's hesitation over the Falklands, invasion of Grenada. When the Americans want to do something, they don't let the relationship get in the way of their national interests.
Which is not surprising. You describe a country in your book, and I'd say a Conservative Party in particular, which perhaps misunderstood its comparative leverage after the Second World War. You were just talking about that. Not least thanks to a formidable imperial history that can't be denied, or the impact of English or common law, for example. Do you think this weight of empire still distorts the picture and our understanding of ourselves and our leverage?
I think it does, sadly. Having sort of spent 3 or 4 years sort of mining the files, and also indeed talking to retired and existing diplomats and policymakers, my favourite quotation in this whole story is one from this chap called Henry Tizard, who during the war had worked for Winston Churchill as a special envoy to Roosevelt, and after the war became chief scientist at the Ministry of Defense. And back in 1949, he issued this warning. He said, and I quote, "We are not a great power and never will be again. We are a great nation. But if we continue to behave like a great power, we will soon cease to be a great nation." And that's I think encapsulated is the tension that's run through our foreign policy since, you know, since 1945, since the war. And we've never really, even now, paid enough attention to that distinction made by Tizard between, you know, we are a great nation and we can celebrate that, but we mustn't presume that we are still one of, as Churchill used to talk about it, the big three, that we have global reach, but we no longer can send gunboats around the world to sort of settle global problems. And that tension has not gone away. And there have been, I think, there's also within this, wrapped in this, there's been this false choice that we've imposed on ourselves, which is, are we European, a regional power, or are we a global power? Now, in reality, there's no need to distinguish between the two. You can be a strong European power while retaining our strong global links and influence. But for reasons of psychology and culture and politics, ever since the 60s, when we first contemplated joining the then common market, we've drawn this distinction and imposed this tension between those two things.
You think unnecessarily so?
Absolutely unnecessarily so. I mean, you know, now the present government talks about global Britain, and it's obviously sensible that we should, you know, be out there building closer relationships with the fastest growing parts of the world. But there's nothing in a close relationship with Europe that would necessarily obstruct that. Whether, you know, we're outside the EU now, but let's, you know, but we hopefully will build a fairly close relationship with the EU. But the two are not antagonistic. And, you know, one only has to look at Germany, you know, the biggest exporter to China. And it doesn't see its, if you like, global economic vocation as in conflict with its Europeanness.
Doesn't see it as a zero-sum game.
We'll
explore perhaps some structural reasons why the United Kingdom might have ended up leaving the European Union anyway in a little while. I think that's worth a discussion. One of the interesting portions I found of Britain alone was the coverage of discussions in the Foreign Office in the 1950s. You mentioned Selwyn Lloyd earlier, which seemed pretty realistic and sensible. He said in a paper that he wrote, as we mentioned earlier, that full alignment with the US reduces influence. One wonders whether the proponents of the Anglosphere, you say the US isn't interested particularly in the Anglosphere, but those in the British Conservative movement who are interested in it, do you think they've found a way round that paradox that Selwyn Lloyd identified?
I don't think they have. I mean, the Americans are interested in it insofar as it's one, if you like, part of the sort of foreign policy toolkit. The problem, I think, is that we invest too much in it. Oh, clearly, you know, there are things and we do, you know, that we do with, you know, what you might call the Anglosphere, the Five Eyes in terms of intelligence that are useful. And there are others that can be done. But again, it's a false choice to say that, you know, one either does it with the English speaking nations or one does it with European nations or indeed others. And the Americans see it as just like that. They see a very useful relationship with the UK through the Five Eyes, for example, intelligence arrangements with New Zealand, Canada, Australia. But they did see, until we left, also a very useful relationship with the UK through its membership of the EU, where the UK was the spokesperson, as it were, for open liberal economics and for strong defence of Europe. So, again, I think we have created in our approach to the world unnecessary tensions vis-a-vis the world and Europe and vis-a-vis Europe and the United States.
I'd like to go on to explore a bit whether we think that Brexit was inevitable, all sorts of things to explore there. Omfis spends a lot of time talking about the development of the Eurozone. The COVID bailout measures have moved that on a little bit. And there are some say that once the Eurozone was set in motion, it was inevitable perhaps that the UK would fall out of the EU eventually, and that it would be forced to choose between the two Western camps that were inside NATO that you also described being built. So could we say that Brexit is as much a rational move away from the problems of European integration as much as it is a mistaken sense of leverage and self-importance?
I think that theory, as it were, works if one assumes that the euro, the development of the euro, is going to create real economic union, as it were, within Europe, and that, you know, there is this inevitable path towards, you know, a big European budgets, decisions, you know, the fabled United States of Europe that we've talked about, that many talk about for so long. If, like me, you think that actually that what's going to happen in the next 10 or 15 or 20 years is that the Europe of 27 will, and it may become 30 or whatever, but a Europe of that size is inevitably going to run at several different speeds with different nations doing different things at different times. Then you think, and I certainly thought, that Britain's in some ways semi-detached position within that grouping was perfectly sustainable. So I, you know, there were clearly going to be awkwardnesses in, you know, in negotiating within the EU. But given that we remain a European nation, given that our economic interests remain essentially European and our security interests are almost identical to the rest of Europe, we're going to have to negotiate anyway with the European Union. And the question was, you know, would we be better negotiating from within, or be in a sort of rather semi-detached way, or from outside? And those on my side of the argument said, well, actually, you're much better in a much stronger position with more leverage negotiating new arrangements from within. And also, as the Americans will tell you, that strengthens your other relationships. I mean, one of the enduring truths, I think, about our post-war foreign policy has been that up until now, our voice in Brussels has amplified our voice in Washington, and our voice in Washington has amplified, in turn, our voice in Brussels. So they have been mutually supportive. Now we've, if you like, switched one of them off.
And you wouldn't regard Brexit then as necessarily inevitable. You think perhaps your view would be that the UK could have survived in one of Macron's concentric circles, or perhaps it's a Venn diagram, but you think that would have been sustainable despite the steps to fiscal integration, perhaps with the core group?
Yes, absolutely. And I don't think, you know, I have a question mark about, you know, how far those steps will actually go. You know, having, you know, spent a lot of time in France and Germany and these other countries, I don't see them giving up the national choices over spending and taxation that would they'd be required to if you created a full economic union within the Eurozone. Now, that means that the currency construction is not going to be satisfactory. But I see a Europe of, as you mentioned, of sort of concentric, and Macron has suggested, of concentric circles. And actually, you know, I think that, you know, 10, 15, 20 years time, when the rawness of our recent debate has eased, we will be looking for a place in one of those concentric circles. It may not be called membership of the EU, but we need, because you know, the fundamentals of our national interests are so aligned with those of the European neighbours, we're going to have to find a place in one of those circles.
Do you think that it would have been possible then, as I've heard some people close to Theresa May say, that what should perhaps have happened after the Brexit referendum is that the UK would be quickly moved to the EEA, say, on a fixed time limit while the country worked out what to do next. Perhaps Cameron, I have heard, might have just about had enough political capital to get that done. Do you think a course such as that might have been possible or realistic, given the emotional state of the Brexit discussion?
I think with a strong leader, a strong and determined leader, it would have been possible. But Cameron, I think, was neither strong nor determined on these questions. And I don't think he would have been able to do it. But certainly in the days and weeks after the referendum results, there was no real conception that we would step so far out of Europe as we've done now with such a hard Brexit. And it would have been perfectly plausible, I think, with a strong new Conservative leader who had been prepared to step across the aisle, as it were, in the House of Commons and get Labour Party support or the support of some Labour MPs. It would have been possible to get to that position. But as things turned out, we had a, Theresa May's famous phrase, Brexit means Brexit, was the definition of a government that had no idea what Brexit actually meant or what indeed it should mean in terms of the future relationship.
And that's perhaps still not entirely clear. I wanted to explore that briefly before we go back to look at other relationships. For the proponents of Brexit in the current government, and it's largely made up of those, do you think Brexit is a romantic project or a rational one? It started somewhat as the idea that economically the UK could capture the faster growth rates of emerging markets while Europe languished and so forth. Then it became a discussion about the concept of sovereignty in particular. Which of these impetuses is driving the current government, in as much as we can tell, based on your good contacts with people around the government?
You know, in a significant, sizable section of the Tory party, there is this attempt, if you like, to reclaim the past, the nostalgia that looks back to days when we could make our own choices, when we had won the war. I mean, I'm struck by the number of people who still talk now about 1945 and that we were the undefeated nation, and others, you know, the French were invaded, the Germans were the absolute villains. And so I think that framing as us, you know, as an empire and then remaining a global force, a global power, is still there. And you see it, I think, in some of the arguments we're now having about our history and how history is taught and, you know, the way that we treat, the way we look at empire. These sort of cultural tussles are about, you know, identity, are, you know, about us trying to find a new identity. And there's certainly certainly your sort of reactionary strand, which says, look, you know, we didn't have to change. And also there is this emotional cultural attachment to our form of government, a British exceptionalism, which says that, you know, democracy in our country has been much more deeply rooted than in many of these countries on the continent, and that its common law foundations don't fit with the European system. So there are those things. On the economic side, the Brexit side has always had two rather competing elements. There are those who say, yes, and this you hear from Boris Johnson, the sort of buccaneering, here's our chance to sort of set off again in this sort of second Elizabethan age to sort of conquer the world as almost as sort of buccaneers. And then there's a second grouping which reflected perhaps more so in UKIP than in the Conservative Party, but with some, which says, look, you know, this is the point where we should shut up shop, and we should we need to protect our industries, and you know, we need to buy British, we need to do what you hear people say, you know, do what the French do and support their own businesses, and the, you know, almost a sort of old-fashioned national champions approach to it. And I don't think those two things have been reconciled, to be honest. And I don't think this generation of politicians in government from the beginning have had a clear enough view of what they want to see Britain look like post-Brexit. They were very clear that they wanted out of the EU. But if you look at the speeches of, you know, the Boris Johnsons and the Michael Goves and the others, it's very hard to find beyond this, you know, this sort of rich imagery of, you know, maritime power and island greatness. Very hard to see a picture of, a strategic picture of, for us in the world. And we have, you know, the government's supposed to publish, in the next month or two, its conclusions of its foreign policy and defense and strategic review. The discussions I've had with officials involved in drawing that up have led me to believe that we shouldn't expect anything too dramatic or too different from a stitching, much more than a stitching together of our various interests in the world. I don't think there's no political scientists talk about grand strategy for nations. I don't think there's a grand strategy anywhere in Whitehall or Westminster at the moment.
Just on the cultural point you just mentioned, just as painting primary colours to draw the point out, whereby you have an undemocratic Napoleonic project in the EU, say, for sake of example, and a common law-based world that we'd be better doing business with, and certainly there are people who believe that in UKIP as well as in the Conservative Party and advisers close to the Prime Minister. Is that a practical point, or is it a romantic one in your view?
I think in some businesses and in some financial services businesses and others, there is a sort of practical, you know, the sense of, you know, let's not tie ourselves up in structures and rules and regulations. Let's be, you know, we need to be free of that. There is a practical application. But I think most of the time it's essentially a cultural, historical question of, you know, of identity, really, and our image of ourselves. And so I don't think there is a big, you know, economic point there.
Within the Conservative Party, as far as we can tell, there's a, shall we say, an autarky camp who don't want to surrender sovereignty either to the EU or, for example, to the US on food standards. And there's another camp which, shall we say, believes in the Anglosphere and that we should move our regulatory coverage from the EU essentially to the US, because you're going to need to make a choice. What's your view of how that will unfold in the Conservative Party while they're still the party in power?
Well, yeah, as you know, you've identified the very clear tension then between these, the different groups in the Conservative Party, the sort of, yes, the free trade, let's open everything up group, who say, yes, let's do a trade deal with the Americans. Let's do one, you know, with, you know, countries around the world and open things up. And there are the others who are the, you know, I was going to say Little England. I'm not sure it's Little England, but anyway, the more protectionists who say, hang on. You know, we don't want to have to eat chlorine-washed chickens from the US, and we don't want American businesses to have a role in managing the NHS, and we don't want to open up all our public procurements. And that tension has not been resolved. It overlays another tension in the Conservative Party now, where you have a big traditional section of the Conservative Party representing the more affluent parts of the country, and this new Red Wall Conservative Party, you know, representing 60, 80 seats in some of the poorest parts of the country, and their interests are not necessarily the same. So I think you have these two tensions between, you know, free market, buccaneering Britain, but also protectionist, close the doors, defend our manufacturing industry, Britain. And I don't see how that's going to be resolved in the Conservative Party easily. But, you know, these things are sometimes managed rather than resolved. And that's what I would look to happen on these questions.
Do you think the conversation will eventually follow the money? I mean, they say that they were expected Brexit referendum to do that and then would argue that it didn't. Do you think economic necessity will eventually dictate policy?
I think it will, but it could take a long time. If you think, as I always thought, that Brexit will be costly for the UK, but the cost will come over many, many years in, if you like, slower growth rather than, you know, a big immediate fall in output. How long is it before you begin to realise that, you know, a quarter or 0.5% of growth foregone every year makes a huge difference? Does that take 5 years or does it take a decade? Does it take, I mean, my fear, and I hope this, I prove wrong here, is it'll be rather like the 1970s when after the very fast growth in Germany, France and Italy through the 60s as well as the 50s meant that we woke up in the 70s and suddenly realized that if you went to Paris or you went to Bonn or went to these other places, things were rather nicer there. You know, the roads were better, the schools were better, they were building new hospitals, the trains seemed to be better. That was the effect of faster growth over quite a long period. So my fear is that we will wake up in, I don't know, 2030, and at that point realise how much Brexit has cost us.
Relative to which economies would expect that? Of course, the Brexit case was, as I mentioned, somewhat predicated on faster growing emerging markets. We'll come on to whether we can do business with them in a moment. Europe has all sorts of headaches, is expected to recover more slowly from COVID in economic terms in the US and China. You'd still expect us to perform less well than, say, the European Union over the time period you've just mentioned?
Well, if I look at productivity in France, Germany, I mean, I'm not going to say every European country, but, you know, looking across the EU, at the larger economies, the Nordic economies, northern economies, more so, I'd expect their growth to outpace us over the next 10, 15 years, yes. And I don't think, even if we sort of push out, you know, quickly and hopefully successfully to some of these new growing markets, there isn't, you know, they're so small at the moment that there isn't time to make up the losses that we're suffering from pulling back from the European Union. I mean, we all know even now how many, I think most of us have got friends or acquaintances who are setting up distribution depots in the Netherlands or in northern France, or who are establishing new representative offices in, you know, in Dublin or Frankfurt or Amsterdam. You know, these are all quite small things, but the accumulation of them, I think, become very costly, and we're not going to be able to sell enough extra to India, to China, to Latin America, to Africa, to make up for the losses that we face in these very big markets.
Well, if that's true, then sir, we may end up wanting to realign with Europe at a later date, perhaps. There are many different views on that, on how long or if at all that would happen. Your book, Britain Alone, talks about the seesaw between the US and Europe in terms of the pull on the UK last 70 years, say. Would you expect then that the UK would edge back closer to Europe, or would it in fact become part of the US regulatory sphere or some other route such as Singapore on Thames?
I think there are going to be differences between different parts of the economy. And I think, you know, if you look at the City of London, there's an obvious pressure now to say, look, you know, let's not look at ourselves in terms of Europe. You know, let's look at ourselves in terms of New York, Singapore and London. and view and take a global perspective on how we govern and regulate ourselves. And I think an area like financial services, where we have a, you know, really quite powerful position, you can do that. But in other areas where, whether services or manufacturing, I think the regulatory pull, the standardization of the European Union is going to be immense, simply because it accounts for such a large proportion of our exports. So if you're producing, you know, widgets for auto manufacturers around Europe, you're going to adopt European standards. If you're a firm of, you know, if you have a consultancy operation, then the first point of reference, I think, is going to be what's happening and the standards and the rules in Europe. And this isn't, you know, because we, you know, Europe is better necessarily, or, but it's because, you know, it's nearly half our trade. So I think there will be a pullback. And I think the other thing is, it's actually, funny enough, is the cultural one, you know, and we see this in our response now to the agriculture. I would have said 10 or 15 years ago, the idea of, you know, cheap food from the US, would have elbowed aside all this discussion about, you know, chlorinated chicken or hormones in beef, whatever. But actually we've become much more, I think, quotes, European in looking at things like food and standards in medicines in a rather stricter way than the Americans do. So I think, yes, we are ironically going to, even as we've left Europe, we're going to pull back. And that's why I said earlier, in some form or another, and I doubt I'd be, you know, the last to try and predict it, we are going to be back in with the EU, if not as part of it. I think Churchill used to say, we're with Europe, but not of it. And that's what we may end up with, in 10 years time, being with Europe, but not quite with the EU, but not of the EU. But yes, that pull, the economic pull, is going to be immense. Also, just to add to this, so is the security pull. I mean, I was talking at the beginning of the year from one of the people involved in doing our sort of strategic and defence and foreign policy review, who said, you know, if you just write on a piece of paper the list of the security threats to the UK, whether they be from Islamist terrorism, from Putin's adventurism in Eastern Europe, from uncontrolled migration, from cross-border international criminal networks, from attacks, cyber attacks from the Chinese and the Iranians and the Russians. He said, if you draw up a list like that and then you sit with your French counterpart and your German counterpart, your Italian counterpart, and ask them to draw up lists, you'll find the lists are almost identical.
But also the security angle, doesn't that anchor us more with the US? The security services obviously work closely together. Our defence establishments are somewhat intertwined. Doesn't in that area the pull work the other way?
No, we are anchored. Certainly in our defence and our security relationships, we're anchored with the US. But our security threats, the threats we face to our security, are ones that we share very closely with all our European partners. Now, some of those, the Americans also share. And, you know, Russia, China, the big ones. But equally, and we've seen this with Trumpism, but we'll see it with other Americans. Equally, the Americans don't want to be responsible anymore for the Middle East or Africa. And more of the, if you like, local threats, from whether it's jihadi terrorism coming from the Sahel, whether it's, you know, as I say, uncontrolled migration, Europeans are going to have to deal with one way or another. And ours are the same. So there will be, I would argue, and I think that, you know, British officials will also, there will be a pull. And this is not either or, you know, this is not, we don't have to make a choice here between the Americans and Europeans, but there will be a pull towards more cooperation with the Europeans simply because we share the same immediate threats.
You spend time on the book on the Iraq War as an interesting incidence of where the UK government was forced to do something that was going to make it unpopular in order to please the US. Do you think that the establishment, such as there is such a thing, learned from that and won't do it again, or will inevitably Brexit Britain be pushed in that kind of direction again?
Well, I think Brexit Britain will be certainly, initially at least, pushed closer to the US and will feel, and our politicians will feel, that since they don't have leverage in Europe, they'll feel more needy about the relationship with the United States. And I think you'll see this government and, you know, perhaps future ones being a little bit more supine towards the US. What I don't think is going to happen again, though, is I don't think we're going to have any more of these what might be called wars of choice. The wars fought in Iraq and indeed Afghanistan were wars which didn't have to be fought. And I think we're not going to have them because America doesn't want them anymore. And I don't think we in the UK would support them a second time. And also, you know, by the by, our defence forces have been very significantly reduced even since the Iraq War. So I don't think there'll be that so blunt a tension as we saw during the Iraq War. But I think there'll be plenty of occasions where the US will want us to do things which we'll feel uncomfortable with, and but we might say, well, look, having detached ourselves from Europe, we can't afford to drift too far from the Americans.
On perhaps a good example of that, the relationship with China, which in one sense was an argument in favour of Brexit. There are others who say Germany does just fine doing business with China from within the EU. But relations with China bring this tension to light a bit. Ivan Rogers was pointing out that if we do take the Singapore on Thames route, I just mentioned, it might have the most GDP benefits, but we'll have to forget about having a foreign policy. But you've also got the China Research Group, say, and the Conservative Party pushing in the other direction. So which path do you think we will take there?
It's a very good question, and because our China policy has been, you know, literally turned on its head in 5 years. I mean, go back to 2015, and David Cameron and George Osborne were talking about Britain as China's best friend in the world, in the Western world, and China was going to be allowed open access into our digital economy. It was going to be, you know, part of building the new generation of nuclear plants. You know, the red carpet was sort of, you know, laid out almost permanently. And now we are, at least among European nations, among the most strident in our criticism of the government in Beijing, whether it be over Hong Kong, whether it be over treatment of the Uyghur population, the internment of millions of Muslim citizens, or whether it be over China's attitude towards the South China Sea and freedom of navigation. So we're in this strange position that before Brexit was seen as an opportunity to, you know, build a new relationship with China. And now the political relationship with China is such that it's very hard to see how that economic relationship will be built. Of course, we'll, you know, China will continue to do business with us because they'll do business with people who they think it's to their advantage with. But we are now politically much more closely aligned with the United States than we were 5 years ago. So, you know, looking to China as the source of a sort of export bonanza or an investment boom, you know, is no longer a plausible route. So we're in now the sort of murky territory where foreign policy and economic policy, or foreign policy interests, strategic interests, sometimes collide with economic interests, and some awkward balancing has to go on. But I think now we're pretty much with the Americans taking a hardish line towards China, harder, for example, than certainly Germany, and certainly slightly less so than France.
It's always not impossible that we might say one thing and do another, of course, but what you're saying in summary is that we'll prioritise the geopolitical over the economic if we're forced to choose in this instance.
Well, I think we have, is what I'm saying, is if you look at the statements that come, you know, some pretty tough statements from the Foreign Secretary over Hong Kong, tougher than I think certainly we would have heard 2 or 3 years ago, the offer of a route to citizenship from a large number of citizens of Hong Kong. It's hard to see how that sort of collision with Beijing is unwound anytime soon. So, you know, I'm not sure whether one thinks about prioritizing it in such a sort of specific way, but I think, and you mentioned yourself, the China research group of conservative MPs who are pretty hostile to a close relationship with Beijing. So, I think the impact will be that the geopolitical will take precedence over the economic, even if that's not a sort of conscious strategic decision.
Back to the domestic scene briefly for a moment. Brexit, for various reasons, seems to be straining. The union may already have been strained, both in Ireland and Scotland, and some are quite worried about this. We know that Michael Gove is worried about it. When we spoke to Philip Rycroft, who ran the Brexit department as a civil servant for a while, it was most worried about this over other issues. Do you think the union will survive teething problems, or is there a fundamental threat to it in your view?
I think this is, you know, the most potentially damaging consequence of Brexit. And it's one of those areas where, as you know, one feels quite sort of fearful as a unionist, as someone who believes very powerfully that as a group of nations, we are much better together than apart. One doesn't want to sort of tempt fate, as it were, but it's, I think, fair to say that if you look at what's been happening in Scotland, accelerated, I think, by the differences in the handling of the COVID crisis, that there must be a pretty strong chance that sometime in the next 5 to 10 years, Scotland will vote for independence. The reason I think for that is, well, I think there are two reasons. One, Brexit does indeed change the choice for, if you're Scottish, in 2014 when the last referendum was held. And people forget this, but, you know, the pro-union side campaigned on the basis that a vote for the union was a vote for Europe and was a vote for Scotland's place in Europe. And were warning that if Scotland voted for independence, it might be locked out of Europe. So now the choice, though, if you're Scottish, is between the union with the United Kingdom or a relationship with Europe. So I think that's one fundamental that's changed. Another fundamental that you can see in the voting patterns in the referendum, where younger people are much, much less emotionally attached to the union and more attached to the idea of being European. And so, you know, demography is on the side of the, sad to say, on the side of the SNP. I think the third factor is, and this is the one where, you know, unionists in England should really be doing things now, is, you know, we can't, as the government seems to think, just say, look, you know, it's what you've got and that's it. We have to recognize that, you know, the union is evolving, that Scotland and indeed, you know, I think Wales and to a degree Northern Ireland are going to require more self-government. And so if we want to win, if unionists want to win a referendum, another referendum, and I'm sure we'll have one, as I say, within 5 or 10 years, then it has to be with an offer for Scotland and indeed for England and for Northern Ireland and for Wales which is of a different union, of a more federal structure, which allows Scotland to breathe politically in a way that it feels it can't now. And there I fear, you know, the Prime Minister simply saying, well, I'm not going to give them a referendum, just invites the SNP to argue that, you know, this is a question of, you know, being shackled to England and whatever. So I'm quite fearful. I think in Ireland, the border question we've seen is it's going to be really difficult. I don't think there is going to be a rush in the north for Irish unification. I do think if the system as it's now constructed survives, and again 5, 10, 15, 20 years, then the economic pull of Europe on Northern Ireland will be very powerful. And, you know, again, you could see Northern Ireland move into some arrangement, whether it's unification or partnership with the Republic, which would take it out of the Union. But so I think, yeah, I think we could, again, you know, this is why the sort of slow burn effects of Brexit may be the most sort of the ones we regret the most. We could, you know, in 2035 be looking back on a union that hasn't grown as fast as its neighbours, so is less prosperous, but is also breaking up or has broken up.
Let's see how that unfolds. Maybe Ursula von der Leyen has inadvertently helped British unionists with the vaccine debacle, the others like it, but the structural issues will remain as well. So let's see how that unfolds. We talked earlier about some of the romantic ideas behind Brexit, and perhaps they're rooted in a real uniqueness for the UK. And I wanted to explore that briefly with you, with a source of lingua franca, a source of common law. You mentioned that. We've got a global network descending from empire. We used to deliberately work these three circles of US, Commonwealth and Europe. To what extent is the UK unique in your view? And to what extent is that also its curse?
I've been writing about British exceptionalism, you know, unique, a sense of being unique. And someone sort of chided me gently and said, look, you know, all nations think they're exceptional. They all have some, you know, unique. True enough, go to France and you won't find any nation prouder or more certain of their unique role in the world. I think our story is an extraordinary story. You know, if you look at, you know, this sort of small islands off the coast of Europe, creating this vast empire. And, you know, it's only 70 years ago since, you know, our monarch was Emperor of India. So it is a, you know, it is an exceptional story. But what I would say is that we have tried longer than most to hold on to this in a way that has made it harder for us to prosper in the present and the future. The former journalist, late Hugo Young, wrote a very good book about our relationship with Europe, which was called This Blessed Plot. And as I recall, he said, you know, this is a story about a nation trying to reconcile an unforgettable past with an unavoidable future. And I think that captures quite a lot about, you know, the way that we have as a nation looked at our identity over the last 50 or 60 years. We've tried to reconcile our sense of ourselves as global citizens and people who have shaped large parts of the world with the reality that we, you know, although we're still the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world, we're now in the second rung of powers. And I think we've just found that a lot harder than many other nations.
You mentioned France's sense of self. France has a imperial history and projected power far beyond its size, just as we did. Admittedly, there's no French US. But would you say then that they've played a cannier game, notwithstanding all the European structural headaches that it still has to deal with?
I'm not sure whether it's a cannier game. And, you know, one detects going to France quite a lot of the angst about the past and future in France that he detects here. It manifests itself in different ways, but, you know, some of the problems that France is now having with its minorities and, you know, it's very closely linked, of course, with its imperial past. I think what one would say about France is that it's been more single-minded, I think, in pursuing this route, which is to be, you know, the most significant power within Europe while retaining this capacity to intervene outside. I think it's been more strategic and single-minded than Britain has been. And I think it's done rather well. You know, one of the complaints that you hear from British diplomats is that how is it that the French, you know, sort of managed to insult the Americans and refuse to do what the Americans tell them and then still end up being called, as Biden called them the other day, you know, our fondest and oldest ally. So I think the French have played their cards really well. But I see France and Britain, you know, as, you know, often talked about as the best of enemies. And it is, you know, perhaps, you know, one of history's, modern history's tragedies that France and Britain somehow didn't get together pre-Suez, post-Suez, whatever, and shaping, if, you know, it's the famous Jean Monnet phrase that, you know, our failure to join the European Union or the coal and steel community at the beginning was the price of victory in the war. And I think had we been in at the beginning with France, then Europe would have looked a different place, and perhaps we would have been more comfortable with the transition from empire.
Do we think then, to finish up where we began with your book Britain Alone, that France and the UK are still living inside the consequences of the decisions they took after Suez that we mentioned at the beginning?
Yes. I think basically yes, except I think it's now harder for Britain. I mean, anyone who follows foreign policy in Britain remembers the famous remark of Dean Acheson in 1962 when he chided the British government, then Macmillan's government, for, you know, being leading a country that had lost an empire and failed to find a role. And in a way, I think we did find a role, and it was an uncomfortable one in many respects, but we found a role which balanced our strong relationship with the US with our engagement in Europe. Now, there were lots of tensions between those two, but for 40 odd years or so, we did actually manage to project our influence and defend our national interests within a strategy that gave us close relationships with both Europe and the US. We've sort of kicked away one of the pillars now, the European pillar. So we have, I think, now this rather, well, it's a completely unbalanced position of just relying on the Americans. Have, as I say, even while building Europe as a, in sometimes in counter, as a counterweight to the US, has retained a strong relationship with the US. But of course, France has a separate problem now, which was the whole assumption that Europe was built on the assumption that although Germany might be the leading economic power, France would always remain the political leader. Since unification of Germany, that's no longer such a plausible proposition. So France has its own problems within Europe. So neither have had great success. I would say, though, that the French have been more confident, I think, in carving out a new position for themselves.
That's an interesting distinction. Philip Stevens, thank you very much for talking to us today. Congratulations on your excellent book, Britain Alone. And do please, listeners, go and check that out. And Philip, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a fascinating conversation.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.